Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Varta Weekly. I am Roshan Karyappa. I have with me Abhishek Paul and Nirav Kanodra to run you through the news and events of the week that was. It was a pretty slim week with one dhamaka of an article that opened up a Pandora's box. We'll talk about India's alleged assassinations in Pakistan. This is in reference to the Guardian article that came out, alluding to that. Then there is the India-Sri Lanka Kachativu row, based on the Prime Minister's remarks. The Congress party also unveiled the Panch Nyay manifesto. We'll talk about that. And of course, we'll round things off with a few updates from the IPL. If this is your first time on this channel, we publish content on politics, policy and culture. We publish a couple of episodes or more. Do follow or subscribe to us on your favorite platform to stay updated. All right, Abhishek, Nirav, hope the week has been great for you guys. Let's start with India's alleged assassinations in Pakistan. On Thursday, British news site The Guardian broke reports of the Indian government supposedly killing terrorists in Pakistan. The article made bold claims of Indian officials infiltrating IS and other terror organizations to pose as locals and then carry out these assassinations. The report, however, as pointed out by several users on X or Twitter, was filled with inaccuracies and shoddy writing with unreliable and biased sources. Some of the inaccuracies include misnaming RANW as RAW, claims that Khalistani terrorist Gurpatwant Singh Panun was dead, using photos of the wrong terrorists, and so on. Defense Minister Mr. Rajnath Singh on Friday reacted to the article, saying that if any terrorist tries to disturb the country's peace, we will give a befitting reply. If they run back to Pakistan, to Pakistan mein guske marenge. Well, all right. It seems like the Guardian has become the star campaigner for, the government in some sense, right? So, Nirav, what do you make of the article and also the response from the defense minister?
Yeah. So, I think the article is obviously, like, they are trying to do like a hit job. It's a little bit biased and has a lot of factual errors. So, once something has a lot of factual errors, you think that why would I ever bother about it, or so like that kind of like puts everything else what is there,
yeah, to makes it a little suspect.
Yeah, so you can just ignore it. But also, see, there is one thing, it's a very condescending tone. So Osama bin Laden was found in Pakistan and was executed there by the US, who took responsibility. So you have like kind of double standards for what the Western countries do versus what the other, the global South or whatever, the lesser developed countries like India have done. So I don't even know whether it is true or not. Pakistan is a pretty, you would say, not lawless, but where law and order isn't really well maintained. There are a lot of rival factions. There could be a lot of people. And lastly, there's one part which mentioned that the government gave notice to some terrorists to stay safe. So this is the thing. Why are they harboring terrorists? Like, if you have people who are suspected of having committed crimes in another country, then should they be living in your country, or should they be put to put in prison, or any other form of law enforcement action needs to be taken against them? So anyways, all of this, all it has done is just actually within India, it has actually raised Modi's popularity, probably. But outside India, the ones who don't like India or who don't like Modi will say, oh no, he's doing these unlawful activities in other countries, etc., etc. So it is just reinforcing everybody's existing biases or stereotypes. Whereas the article may be complete fiction, maybe propaganda or some perceptions. All it does is on the internet, it strengthens your bias whichever way it was before. So I would just take it with a fistful of salt. It's not much. It is what it is, and just it is best ignored.
Yeah, fistful of salt, some lemon and tequila as well, I suppose, on a Saturday evening. Right? Yeah, I mean, Pakistan is in such a turmoil at this point of time that it is perhaps, I mean, very naive to attribute one of these murders or supposed murders to India, right? I mean, look at the case of, you know, singers and artists and performers being regularly bumped off, right? Or politicians themselves. I mean, I was reading about this Amjad Sabri, who was, again, murdered because he didn't pay up the regular hafta or something of that sort, right? I mean, so all kinds of things have happened there. But yeah, Abhishek, a very sort of a subtle response from the defense minister, right? I mean, not saying much in the sense not denying directly, but then saying that, hey, I mean, if it is a case of terrorism, we won't hesitate to step across the border.
Yeah, I think with previous retaliations, let's say, that the Indian armed forces have done in the Modi era, they have definitely crossed the previously understood to be red lines, right? So it used to be certainly a policy that India will not cross the line of control while, you know, doing, let's say, counter-terror operations and things like that. So that red line has definitely been erased. And so now, while India can definitely deny these specific cases of, you know, random, you know, local jihadis, you know, who have been mysteriously dying in Pakistan, and we don't really need to take credit for any of this, right? Like, who knows? And we don't need to know anyway. So, but the point is that the government says that they definitely retain the option for retaliating across the border in case of, you know, significant terror attacks or things like that.
Yeah. All right. What do you guys think? I mean, did the Indian agencies actually do this or, yeah? Well, let us know in the comments. Moving on to another controversy. Last week, Prime Minister Modi on Twitter said that the details about the Kachchatheeva island between Sri Lanka and India had revealed, to quote DMK's double standards, the details about the status of the island were revealed in an RTI request and stated that the Indian government in 1974 ceded the island to Sri Lanka as part of a bilateral agreement between the two governments. The Prime Minister and Minister for External Affairs, Dr. S. Jaishankar, slammed the Congress Party and DMK, saying they never had India's interests in their heart and have only worked to further their families' statuses. The Sri Lankan government said that India's statements of reclaiming the islands, to quote, hold no grounds, and that there is no need for any talks with the Indian government as it is on expected lines with the elections coming up. Abhishek, interesting timing for this as well. But is there a larger sort of a significance to this? I mean, I know that India and Sri Lanka have been on good terms now, especially post the crisis in Sri Lanka and our, you know, overwhelming humanitarian support. I think we offered some 2 billion or something, right? Way more than the IMF itself, right? So is this going to deteriorate ties or is this just some political signaling?
Yeah, so as of now, I think it looks like purely political signaling, where, let's say, the opposition from time to time has been, you know, trying to put the government on the back foot with regard to China, Arunachal Pradesh, or, you know, things like that, right? Where did India lose some territory to China in these last 5-6 years and all that, right, in the Ladakh region. So I think the BJP is trying to sort of put question marks on the Congress's, let's say, intentions and capabilities also with regard to foreign policy and their previous track record, right? And so if you look at this particular incident, this was sort of, this small island was sort of given away to Sri Lanka as part of negotiations during 74 to 76 period. But what India had then tried to do was retain the right of Indian fishermen to visit that island without travel documents, right? As so that they can, let's say, dry their fishing nets and things like that. And also there was some particular festival for which, you know, access was supposed to be provided. So since then, of course, India-Sri Lanka relations and let's say Tamil-Sinhalese relations have gone through many ups and downs, right? And so at various points in time, Indian fishermen have felt that, you know, they have got the raw end of the bargain here. And also, I think probably the most pressing complaint is that is of the Indian fishermen, right? Whether they get arrested too soon, or the Sri Lankan Navy is like very stringent and do not, you know, give any sort of benefit of doubt to Indian fishermen, things like that. So I think the fishermen's question remains a sort of bone of contention between both countries. For example, if at any point in time, let's say the central government is able to secure the release of a bunch of arrested fishermen, that probably provides a sort of political benefit or kudos from the public of Tamil Nadu and so on, right? So that is the sort of local dynamic there, rather than the 74-76 question. As far as the bilateral ties go, I don't think it has sort of escalated to that level. I think Sri Lankans have basically said that it is just Indians debating amongst themselves, and for them, they own the island. It's a settled question.
Right. Well, all right, closer home on Friday, April 5th, the Indian National Congress Party released their manifesto for the 2024 Lok Sabha elections. The manifesto is titled Nyay Patra and is centered around the party's commitment to justice through its five pillars. The Panch Nyay includes Yuva Nyay, Nari Nyay, Kisan Nyay, Shramik Nyay, and Hissedari Nyay. The Nyay Patra includes social justice, gender equality, law to recognize LGBTQIA plus community, MSP for farmers, filling government vacancies inclusively, and so on and so forth. Nirav, I don't know if this is like social reform or social re-engineering of some sort, right? But on the face of it, I think it looks benevolent, but the ways and means this could be carried out could have so huge costs economically and socially, I feel, right? I mean, yeah, just looking at some of these guarantees, it's scary how these things will be fulfilled and if they will be fulfilled, right? I don't know. Kapil Sibal is in the news today saying that, you know, how can Modi guarantee anything? It is unconstitutional, right? He can only say that he can try to do some of these things, but these are guarantees, right? I mean, look at MSP for farmers, for instance, right? So, yeah, what do you think about
So,
this?
one is you correctly said all of these are like very much socialist type of policies, as well as it's redistribution of the existing wealth. The problem is India is still a poor country. It is a lower middle income or still a poor country. If you redistribute all the wealth, there is not much left to redistribute from. So I think that is one thing. Maybe see, I am a capitalist person, work in a very capitalist environment, in a very capitalist city outside India. So my views can be very different, but I think clearly they are running out of like any ideas. So what they're doing is they probably shifting the whole discourse so much to the left that the other party, even if they win, they will have to give something. I think MSP was a fantastic idea during the Green Revolution in the 1960s, so that the farmers can plant as much as they can. Earlier, what would happen? I just want to take this one specific example. What would happen is you would have when farmers, the crop is very big, demand is kind of constant, so then the prices collapse, so that is also bad. So very huge crop or very low crop is bad. So the MSP would ensure that there is always some demand, and the government, as a lender of last resort or like the buyer of last resort, will hold this in some godown, which can eventually pay for in times of drought. So, but now maybe we are growing too much rice and wheat in places where we don't need it, and maybe our diets, India's a diabetic, is endemic. So diabetes. So you should be thinking about how can we grow more millets? How can we grow more corn? And we have to move on. See, these ideas of the 1960s. I think reservation is an idea which Ambedkar put up in social justice in the 50s. It's a country we are fighting. Everyone wants to be backward. People are fighting for to be backward status. rather than trying to move ahead, that there should be enough for all. You want to be more forward, right? So I think that is also like, I would say, like a little regressive step. And I think the things like all freebies, like free buses for women or like reservation of jobs, what we want is more efficiency. If say maybe 15% of the women who travel in public buses, and Karnataka has free buses for women, if you really ask a lot of them, bus travel is reasonably priced, it's quite cheap. Would they prefer if there were 15% more buses and the buses were more frequent, you got more space to sit, rather than women paying for free? Would their safety be a bit better? I think we need to think of it that way. Can we grow the pie? Can we have more resources? Can we think about growing? So I think that is what it is. Again, respectfully saying that their ideology is very left-leaning, very socialist. They are looking at redistribution over growth. I think India, where it is at this moment, we are a poor country. There's not enough left to redistribute. If you see this, and that will have to be paid by more taxes, either you see emigration of more wealthy people, or you will see more people hiding taxes, or like not paying their fair share. So I think revamping of GST, you know, removing EVMs, these are all more regressive steps. Removing triple talaq, it's an anti-women thing. So I feel personally that it is something which I don't agree with. And it is for every voter to see what is more important to them and think about it. All I would say is, the politician, no politician who's promising anything is giving from his or her own pocket. There are trade-offs. By spending money in one place, maybe you get less of other things. Could be less of infrastructure, could be less of public services, could be more taxes. It has to be paid somehow. And this is where I'm at. I'm very open in my economic leanings. In India, sadly, politically, there is no country, no party which is enough right-wing for me. So I have to make a choice, whatever it is. Most probably, I might go and vote, let's see, 20th May, Mumbai North, Govinda versus Amol Kirtikar are the two candidates, Shiv Sena and Shiv Sena UBT. And I will make my decision. But yeah, I think the INC manifesto seems very, very leftist. It seems more like the Communist Party manifestos, and my views are quite different. As in, respectfully, people can have their own views. People can vote as per their liking, and everyone is entitled to their vote and vote wisely. And be careful what you are voting for.
Yeah, I mean, you said it rightly. You know, I mean, this feels like going back 25, 30 years, or perhaps even more, right? I mean, moving back to ballot papers, some of these reservations, and so on and so forth, right? I mean, India's aspirations have, you know, vastly moved on from this, right? I mean, I don't think a young person in India, irrespective of their status, irrespective of whether they're in the metros or villages or tier one or tier three or whatever, can relate to this more than they can relate to what the Prime Minister says, right? Which is development for all, right? And like improving the general circumstances for everyone, right? Whether it's labor, capital, or productivity. None of these schemes kind of promote that. I mean, they seem to be like rearranging the pieces on the board rather than, you know, thinking how to grow the pie, right?
I think I want to add one more thing. And here, what I feel is, UPA government in UPA 2, their flagship program was NREGA. And while there is a lot of positive things to say, etc. about it. So there's one thing where you could give cash in hand. And I would say a lot of investment, directed investment has been in the NDA government, has been har ghar jal. So you get piped water, cooking gas, you get toilets, cooking gas, toilets as well, right? Swachh Bharat. So you get toilets installed. So what one is giving you is cash, and you are free to spend it whichever way you want. A lot of times it is inflationary because it doesn't add any capacity. And your circumstances kind of remain the same. Whereas the other one is actually adding capacity. And adding capacity, improving infrastructure. India's infrastructure is still abysmal. But you can say it is probably better than what it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Intra-city is still very bad because cities have grown too fast. intercity is slowly improving. So I think about these two examples, right? That one was NREGA and the other one was giving people like direct transfer of getting gas connections, getting LPG, getting water, getting toilets in every house, or like trying to make it open defecation free. We are far from perfect, but we've also come far from where we were. And think about what would you rather have, like 100 rupees every day, but you don't have to go to toilet in the fields in the open, right? I think that is a choice. That is a clear difference between, I would say, the two big groups which are contesting.
Right. Oddly enough, the Nyayapatra also has some aspects of foreign policy covered. They want to mend relationships with the Maldives, and they say the onus should be on us, right? They also want to realign the China policy. Now, that sounds, again, ominous to me, right? I mean, considering it's a hostile country and we've had multiple skirmishes and whatnot, right? So yeah, it is what it is, I suppose. I mean, people, I hope they make an educated decision when they're, at the ballot boxes, right? So, all right, moving on. As I said, it's a very slim week. So we're going to end with some updates from the Indian Premier League. Over the past week, well, nothing much changed on the RCB front. We continued to lose games. The last one was on April 2nd against the Lucknow Super Giants, who won by 28 runs. You guys saw that meme, is it? I mean, the most important aspect of an RCB match is the toss, right? Yeah. It decides whether... Exactly, it decides how we lose. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Other matches, Mumbai Indians and the Rajasthan Royals. Rajasthan Royals won by 6 wickets and 27 balls. Kolkata Knight Riders, Delhi Chargers, KKR won by 106 runs. Gujarat Titans and Punjab Kings, won by 3 wickets and a ball. Chennai Super Kings and Sunrisers won, wow, by 6 wickets and 11 balls. Okay, I want to talk about Mayank Yadav. Man, what a killer, killer, killer bowler here. So, I mean, it was bad enough that RCB was losing. So, but the highlight of the match was Mayank Yadav bowling 155, 156 Ks, right? I mean, it's just supremely, it's just delightful to watch an Indian fast bowler clock those speeds. And such a clean action as well, right? So, consistently as well, not like some of the folks we know from the past, right? Who bowl one ball at some 145 Ks and finish the rest of the over at an average speed of 130, right? But... Seems like a real find, guys. What do you think about it?
No, so Mayank Yadav, absolutely. Very exciting prospects. Fingers crossed, he doesn't get injured. Like fast bowlers, especially bowl at this pace, do tend to get injured. We had like a couple of other guys who were not as fast, but like 145 plus. Shivam Mavi and Nagarkoti come to mind, who were like under 19 stars. So hope Mayank Yadav like sustains and has like a long international and a long career in IPL. Very entertaining bowler to watch. But I also want to highlight like a couple of others. So for all RCB fans, I am Mumbai Indians fan. So, we are all in the same boat. I think like a couple of very other exciting players. There is Riyan Parag, who plays for Rajasthan Royals. He's been playing here 17 when he first hit a 50. And now, like five seasons on, he's still 22 only. He's hit 250s. Seems like a very exciting young batsman and a brilliant fielder. If you do notice games, he's always fielding at long on and long off and does like a lot of brilliant saves and a couple of great catches as well. And bowls leg spin. Though a lot of times he's not been called in the T20 setup, maybe in ODIs or like, I don't know if Test cricket he gets in the future. Could be like a nice, decent part-time bowler to chip in with a few overs as well. So, that is one guy. There's young talent, Ankrish Raghuvanshi. He's hit like a 50. There are a lot of guys who've been there. Like you've seen like Devdutt Padikkal, who's played decently. And then, so it's really nice. I think it's nice. We have like a larger talent pool. IPL, they do like a great job overall in unearthing a lot of talent. And like, what we have is now 10 teams. Each team, there are 7 people, or now 8 because of like the substitution rule, who play a game. So 80 players and because of like substitute, like in the squad, etc., about 120 players get to play one level below international cricket with a lot of other international stars. So by having good facilities, good coaches, exposure to international bowlers and batsmen, I think it ups the game quite a bit. So it's really positive for Indian cricket as an ecosystem, creates like a large talent pool. And it's absolutely entertaining. The T20 format is also great. And on a particular day, anyone can win, apart from RCB and Mumbai.
Yeah, I mean, such a plethora of talent, right, for sure. I mean, I think we have enough right now, at least on the T20 side. We could probably, do an India A and India B, like the Australian.
And India C. And India All three C. will be decent teams in the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, folks, that's it. We come to the end of this weekly. If you did stay with us as long and you liked our content, don't forget to share and subscribe. It really helps the algo gods smile upon us. Thank you again for joining us on this weekly. Until next time, from Abhishek, Nirva and myself, do stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.